Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and this is the Downtime Podcast, where we take you inside the world of mountain biking, meet the characters involved, hear their stories and find some insight to help us all get faster on our bikes. This week I'm joined by Eddie Masters to find out a bit about how he managed to get those awesome EWS podiums in 2018 and plenty more. Before we chat to Eddie, I want to thank the Trailhead Bicycle Company in Shrewsbury for supporting this episode. I met the Trailhead owner, Sandy Plenty, when he came on the podcast earlier in 2018. Go and have a listen to that episode if you haven't already. Sandy is a top guy and runs an awesome local bike shop right here in the UK. He's a big fan of what we're doing here on the podcast and wanted to help us keep creating content for you all for free. Hence, he's supporting this episode and a few future episodes. Sandy strongly believes that there is a place for local bike shops, as they offer way more than just somewhere to buy your products. They have the knowledge and the advice that we all need from time to time. They can help us fix our bikes when we have issues, and they're the hub of our local riding communities. So think about where you're spending your hard-earned money. No one, including Sandy, expects it all to be in your local bike shop, but please don't forget them, because you'll miss them if they weren't there. If you're in Shropshire, then you're lucky and you can go and visit Sandy and his team of knowledgeable and skilled staff at the Trailhead in Shrewsbury. If you're not, then there are thousands of awesome local bike shops all around the globe. If you're heading to the Trailhead, then mention you heard this message on the podcast and the staff there will sort you out a Trailhead top cap or a Trailhead fender free of charge. How good is that? You can find out more about the Trailhead at thetrailhead.co.uk over on the internet. And you can find them on Instagram at the_trailhead_bicycle_co. And you can follow Sandy himself on Instagram at sandy_plenty. All those links are going to be in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. While you're there, please head to the subscribe page and subscribe to the podcast, as well as joining the mailing list. That way you'll get all the episodes delivered to your device as soon as they're available and we'll keep you up to date on what's going on. We've also got our web store where you can grab a mug or a t-shirt and all the proceeds help us keep the podcast going. Hoodies and sweatshirts are temporarily out of stock, but we hope to have them back in soon. Also, later this week, we've got another episode with Johnny from Fit for Racing. Johnny's last episode on how to maximise your off-season was our second most popular episode of 2018. So we've got him back to give us a full downhill and enduro-specific workout to help us get ready for the upcoming season of racing. Keep your ears peeled for that. It's coming later this week. Right then, time for this week's guest. We'll be chatting about Eddie's approach to life, his recent ACL reconstruction, how he got on the podium in last year's EWS, and much, much more. So, without further ado, here's Eddie Masters. Eddie Masters, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. Thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks for having me. It's a bit of an honour. You've had some pretty exclusive guests, so it's cool to join the crew.
Yeah, the roster's growing. It's good to have you on board.
Yeah, since I've been injured, I've been listening to a few of them. So yeah, and then I tagged you and you asked me to come on, so I was like, cool, yeah, sweet, come and tell the story.
Yeah, exciting time. So you sat there on a Watt bike and felt pretty sorry for you.
Yeah, the Watt bike's hell, isn't it?
Never nice. Well, at least it's a bike of some sort.
It's a love-hate relationship. Yeah, now I'm back out on a normal bike now, but not quite a mountain bike.
Sweet. All right, good stuff. We'll talk a little bit about your injury in a bit, but I wanted to start with your true love, which appears to be horses.
Yeah. I don't know if it was my true love. It's definitely my mum's true love. And I'm pretty sure that she always kind of wished that she had a girl in the family. So up until about the age of 10, me and my brother were into horses. And then we quickly kind of realized that there weren't that many guys riding horses after 10 years old. So Wynne actually sold his horse and bought a hardtail. And I kind of did what little brothers do and followed suit pretty shortly after.
Yeah, so it's Wynne that got you into riding in the first place then.
Yeah, like we've kind of always been into bikes. And I guess from like probably 6 or 7, we were always building jumps in the backyard. And Wynne was kind of bike mad more than I was. And it's always been a big thing for him. And all he's ever wanted to do was ride bikes. And then, like I said, being the little brother, I kind of just did what he did. And yeah, and it hasn't really stopped. And I've just been following him ever since.
Sweet. Worked out all right, isn't it?
It's been a fun ride.
Am I right in thinking you started off with only a back brake? Is that how you learnt?
No. So when I on my first, I raced downhill for about 2 years with only a, my first downhill bike. My granddad passed away, and I inherited $1,000, and I had a DMR jump bike, and I used that $1,000 and bought a an old Foes DHS tube frame with these Foes forks. Nice. And the Foes forks at the time had, the ones that I had a 30 mil front hub. And this was probably like 2003, 2004. And New Zealand, it's quite hard to get parts back then. So we couldn't actually get a mount or a rotor to fit the hub. So I just raced without a front brake for like 2 years, which is actually coming to bite me in the ass a bit, because we did some brake testing and I favor the back brake so much, so when the tracks get steep it gets a bit loose to because I just ride the back brake.
So that's still carried on, you still prefer the back brake?
Yeah, just naturally. And it's like I said it's a bit of a Achilles heel sometimes, because I always really struggle when it's really steep, like there's that one section in Andorra where you jump off the bridge, and if you're locking up the back brake, the bike's not working like as it should be. So it's always, yeah, it's something I need to work on, but it's really hard to break old habits, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a tricky one, trying to relearn how to use a front brake.
Because I grew up with riding with Blinky, my brother, and we had a really strong downhill scene. And we used to ride the sketchiest, steepest chutes in the wet. And so riding those with only a back brake, I think, has made why us Kiwis are so good in the wet, because we used to ride, we never had mud tires either. So,
yeah. All in. Yeah. Good stuff. So yeah, so you had a pretty good scene. Am I right? You and Wynn went to the same boarding school, yeah?
Yeah. So Wynn got shipped off to boarding school, and I don't think he wanted to go. But then it was kind of like a blessing in disguise, because the mountain bike scene was so big. So that when I turned up, he'd already kind of met Sam Blenkinsop and Glenn Hayden, who was the national champ at the time. And yeah, it was just a really strong scene where you could actually ride downhill, because where we grew up, it's just dirt jumps. And yeah, it kind of just kept on going from there. We could go to races and stuff.
Yeah, for such a small country, you've got a lot of top level riders, so there must be something going on over there. It must be a good scene.
Yeah, it's a really good scene, and like I don't know, Kiwis just get up and go. You go. Yeah, you just make it happen. People go. It's the same for the Brits, though. It's like if you don't have bike parks, because we do now, but we didn't back then. You just go up in the woods, and if you're building rut tracks and session corners, you're picking up skills that you can't really get anywhere else.
Yeah, for sure. So then you went through boarding school, plenty of riding, and you went off to university. You did, is it master's and business degree?
Yeah, so I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And to be honest, like when I finished school in 2007, like being a downhill racer wasn't really a viable career choice. And it was definitely when there was like a bit of a downturn, I guess, in the industry. And I wasn't good enough at all. I raced one junior world champs and made it about 200 meters down the track. yeah, so classic like junior story. But yeah, so I decided I'd go to uni, and I didn't really ride much for the first 2 years. I just partied a bunch and did what, you know, freshers and uni people do. Yeah. But then Justin Leov moved to the town where I was at uni and started a bike shop. And, I was racing a little bit, but I didn't have a downhill bike or a bike at all. So he kind of, him and his dad, who's a legend, called Magnum. Yeah, they like got me a bike or let me use some bikes, and I'd go riding with Justin and stuff. And then they started doing shuttles, and I just kind of fell back in love with downhill.
Awesome. Was it hard watching, you know, Blenky must have been away at World Cups, and watching those guys on probably Freecaster at the time. Was that tough, or were you kind of happy to be back at home?
That was the only reason I kind of thought that was the only reason that I wanted to go and have a crack at racing. Partly so just to do the traveling side, like a bit of a trip away. But also, like, I'd be out in town at like 3 a.m. and I'd like be wasted sprinting home to catch the World Cup, because they used to show everyone. So I'd like, you'd just get back at like 3 a.m, hammered drunk and screaming at the computer. And I kind of just realized that, like, that's where I wanted to go. Whether or not I was good enough, I just wanted to go and have a crack, because it looked like it's a good way to see the world, and it was something I was pretty into.
Yeah, and you were probably about as drunk as Warner was in the booth back then as well.
Oh, maybe a little bit more.
So has the degree been useful to you? Have you used anything of it? Do you think it's helped you get to where you are?
Yes and no. I mean, when you're just doing, like, I did marketing and international business, like double major, and some of it's like common sense, but then other stuff not so much. But it was definitely helpful when I was trying to put together the Bergamont team. But I think I've always kind of known how to promote myself, or knowing what my strengths are, or kind of create a point of difference. So it kind of just came naturally.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So then 2012 rolls around and you're off to World Cups. How did that first season go? Because you kind of threw yourself in pretty deep, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, this is where it's funny, because so 2012 came around and I was like, okay, I've got to go race World Cups. Time to take it a bit serious. So I kind of changed up my approach, and I got a good bike, and I thought I needed the light wheels, those white DT Swiss wheels that lasted like all of one run. And, I thought I needed this and that, and I needed my, the Fox kit with my name on the back and all the stuff that you see all the pros having. But it didn't really help my riding at all. I completely sucked. That's the first race at Val d'Isère, actually, when I ruptured my ACL. And same thing, like my last event in a World Champs. I made it about 200 meters down the track before having probably one of the biggest crashes of my life. And then I proceeded not to qualify at the next three World Cups. I didn't qualify at that Val d'Isère one. That was qualifying anyway. But it was a bit of a, it wasn't a very successful season. But it was a big learning curve, and I did four World Cups, and then I spent 3 months in Whistler. So the 3 months in Whistler was a bit of a treat. So I realized that if I wanted to do this, I was gonna have to be me and not try and be someone else. So the next year, I approached it a bit differently.
Yeah, and that seems to have continued. Like, your general approach of enjoying yourself and having a good time, it seems to work for you. Why do you think that is?
It's just like anything. It's like, be yourself. And so the next year that I went racing, I bought a Zeroed, which is like the heaviest downhill bike, but I didn't want to break wheels and I didn't want to break parts. And I just went riding in a holiday shirt, and me and Matt Walker and Tom Matthews bought a van, and we just went round on a bit of a holiday. We were calling it a holiday. So, and when you're having fun and you're in an environment that's suited to your personality, I guess that's the time that you're best going to perform.
Yeah. You've got a pretty laid back approach to life in general. We had Reese Wilson on the podcast recently, telling us about some of the travel exploits.
I've got to call him out, because he threw me under the bus saying that we were arriving in Fort William and that we had no accommodation, but it was actually 3 weeks before we arrived in Fort William.
Oh, well, there's plenty of time then.
Yeah. There's not plenty of time, because it's so hard to find accommodation.
Yeah, true. Yeah. That town gets booked up.
It was an Airbnb that cancelled on us and said that they were renovating, and I was like, bullshit, I bet you've got friends coming to the race.
Oh, man. And you ended up in a castle or something.
Yeah, and we still stay there now. I passed it on to Bernard. It's so sick. Yeah, it's called Achnacarry Castle. So if Asti, if you're listening to this, cheers for hooking it up.
Nice one. That's awesome. Yeah. So has that kind of laid-back approach ever backfired? Or does it generally, like, if you let things go, things work out?
I guess in some people's eyes they've backfired, but in general... I just try and go with the flow. I mean, some things are out of your control. And for me, it's just about realizing that if something's out of your control, then there's nothing you can do about it. So just ride it out.
Has that come to you naturally, or have you had to work on that? Because it's quite hard to do that in reality, or it is for me anyway.
I guess my parents are like long distance cyclists, and they just go on these massive intrepid missions. And even when we were kids, like if we wanted to do something, we did it, we made a plan. And so we've always kind of had a get up and go attitude. And I guess that's kind of, if you make your own way, then you quickly realize what you're in control of and what you're not.
Yeah, it's a great way to look at stuff, for sure.
Yeah, I know.
So a couple of years.
It has its pitfalls sometimes, but you can't. That's just how you are. So, I guess as you get older, you just realize you figure out who you are, and that's and what works for you. And it's about trying to maximize the gain that you can get for yourself, I guess.
Yeah, nice approach. So you had a few years as a privateer, enjoying yourself, plenty of holiday shirts. And then you ended up running the Bergamot Haze team for a good while.
Yeah.
How did that come about? Because is that something you kind of pitched for and put together?
Yeah. So at the end of 2013, I had a string of pretty good results for a privateer. I think my best result was 26th at Val d'Isole. But it just, at the end of the season, no one was coming knocking on my door, and I didn't really have the means to fund another crack at the World Cups. So I was talking to Matt Walker, who I'd been traveling with, and he was kind of in the same boat. So I was like, shit, let's just do our own team. So what I did is I went on the Eurobike gallery on one of the websites, and they had a gallery of every single downhill bike at Eurobike, and I just made a list of which bike brands didn't had a downhill bike but didn't have a World Cup team, and I just put together a proposal and emailed, you know, just cold called all these companies, and only like three of them got back to me. And it was just funny, at the same time, one of the Bergamot guys had messaged me on Facebook, but had gone into my message requests and asking me if I needed a ride. So then I was just like, you know, it was right time, right place. And I was able to kind of convince them to let us provide them the team rather than me just ride for their team.
That's an impressive bit of talking to get that to happen.
Yeah. But like we were making some videos, and we did our van was called the Mariah, and we had the Mariah TV, so we had some kind of stuff to show them, and we had results. And then Matt Walker actually went and rode for Banshee, so I secured the services of Jack Moyer, which ended up being really good for the team. And we had Casey Brown, so we had a pretty good roster for a team that's running on whole team budget of 30 grand.
Yeah, it's amazing. What does it take to be a good team manager then, having done it for a few years?
I wouldn't say that I was a good team manager, but I think, you know, with the whole go with the flow attitude, no, I was never putting pressure on anyone, and I was, you know, I was equally as stoked as they are just to be racing. So I always kind of just was a rider who was trying to just wheel and deal the stuff behind the scenes. But to be a good team manager is just to know who your riders are. You know, you see, there's sometimes some of the team managers in the pits, like, I wouldn't really want to work with. And it was like, I was reading Conor Fearon's interview on Pink Bike and his reasons why he's staying with Kona. and it's you know, he's happy there, and that's probably because he gets on so well with Matt DePauw, who's his team manager.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah, it was a good crew, and good to see both Jack and Casey going on to big things as well.
Yeah, I kind of just always knew that Jack was going to be a boss. Like he's just, when you ride with him up the Plenty and Morzine in the wet on the routes, he probably could have beaten Sam Hill and Chompery that year.
Wow, that good.
Oh, yeah, he's unreal, man. I think it's because he's got so – I call him Mr. Legs because his legs are like three-quarters the length of his body. But he just he can just counterbalance the bike on anything, and it's like – so, yeah, I was happy to, play a small role in the in Jack's story, because what he's gone on to do, even though he's had some trials and tribulations along the way, it's been real cool to watch. And same with Casey. And same with Reese and Rupert. Like, we've had – so many cool riders come through the team it's pretty cool looking back on it.
Yeah, good stuff. So how did the move to Pivot come about then? Was 2018 your first year on Pivot?
Yeah. So I was just kind of, Bergamot wasn't really, it wasn't really growing. And I just felt like I was getting a bit stagnant, and I wasn't. Bergamot were awesome to deal with, and there's so many good people in the company that we've, like, so many good memories. But it just seemed like it was time to think about me, you know, be a bit selfish for once. So Bernard had always mentioned to me, like, if you do want to come and ride for us, we can probably make a spot on the team. So, it just worked out. And I said, yeah, I'll come ride for Pivot. And so we kind of folded the Bergamot team, but merged the two teams. Like, my mechanic, Kurt, who's been with me the whole time, and Tom Lois, they both are now working for Pivot.
Ah, awesome. Right. Yeah. So you got sort of familiar crew around you then.
Yeah, really. Yeah. So it wasn't like you're joining a new team at all. And then Rupert was on the team, so he was my teammate for 2 years on Bergamot. So it was super easy. Yeah.
And has it helped from a performance perspective, not having to run the team and have all the stuff that comes with that?
I didn't think, if you'd asked me at the end of 2017, I would have told you that everything was fine and dandy. But now looking back, I can see that it wasn't. And I was just, I was always really stressing out because, we were running a pretty tight budget. I'm a numbers guy. So I was just crunching numbers in my head all the time, making sure that it checked out. Because at the end of the season, like, what was left would be kind of my salary. And sometimes there'd be a little bit left, and sometimes there wouldn't be as much as you thought you were going to get. But when you're always thinking like that at a race, or worrying about paying for next week's accommodation, it probably wasn't the most ideal way to be mentally racing. But so now it's, Bernard does a great job, and it's super chill for me, and I'm like really enjoying it.
Awesome, yeah. And the season started off pretty good. You took the New Zealand National Champs back in, was it February?
Yeah. So that's always like a track that I feel like I've been really fast on, but I've always like crashed or done something. So it was really good to get the monkey off the back. And I never thought that I'd be a New Zealand national champ. So to be able to wear the sleeve and have that title was a bit of an honour. So I was really stoked. And I'd had a pretty rough couple of weeks going in there. So it was really cool.
Yeah, and there's some pretty tough competition to beat at a New Zealand national these days. Yeah,
yeah, it's stacked. And then you've got all the blow-ins like Laurie and stuff who come, and we've got pretty good tracks that we race on. So, everyone turns up with their A game. So, and that race especially, it was a stacked field, and to put it down was stoked. I was really happy.
Awesome. What was the word you used for people like Laurie?
Oh, the blow-ins.
Blow-ins. I've never heard that.
Oh, I guess
people that just, it's like blown into town.
Yeah, I guess it's like a surfing term. Yeah,
like it. Never heard that one.
Yeah, So, like, yeah, loads of guys come to Queenstown, like, for, you know, 6 weeks before the season because we've just got, like, such good riding. So you always, yeah, Greg Williamson was coming out for a bit. Bernard's always there. Laurie, Elliot Jackson, all those guys.
Yeah, I've been to Queenstown once, fairly briefly, but I definitely want to come back. It was a pretty special place. So
yeah, we're pretty, like, really lucky. I'm a bit biased, but I reckon it's the best riding in the world.
Interesting. Yeah, I've got to get back there for sure. So at what point did you decide to do more of the EWS this year? Because you had a bit of a go previous season, but then had a pretty much, well, not full series, but had a good go at it for the start of this year.
Oh, it was just kind of the way that we swung pivot for me to join the team. So I guess in Bernard's eyes, in the way that he spoke to me, he was like, yeah, you know, okay, can you commit to doing some enduros? I was like, yeah, no problem. I like, you know, it's a good way for me to train and I really enjoy doing them. But they already had a downhill team. So I guess Bernard's way of spinning it to the pivot powers that be were that I would be an enduro guy who can race downhill.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. So it just meant, and it worked really well because we had the first two races in April. So you got two races out of the way. So then I said that I'd do six races. So I only had four enduros during the regular downhill season. So it wasn't too bad, but it ended up being a pretty jam-packed season anyway.
Yeah, pretty hectic. And you had to miss Mont-Saint-Anne World Cup to be at the Whistler EWS.
Yeah.
Is that part of what fired you up and ended up with a podium?
No, I guess, because I got the podium at La Tuile a couple of weeks before that, I was, I was riding a bit of a confidence and I had a new bike that was almost, you know, it was kind of a transformation from the one that from what I was riding for it was when it came to racing enduro. It was my first 29er.
So was that those two races, were they your first two on the Firebird then?
No. So I raced the Firebird at Petson as well, which I was also I was sitting in second going into the last stage and then I crashed and bent my rotor and got seventh. So it could have been, it was almost three in a row. But yeah, it was really, getting that new bike was, it's an amazing bike, not trying to just plug it, but, the results kind of speak for themselves.
Yeah. So I was going to say what clicked and I was looking back through some photos to try and work out when you switched over onto the Firebird. So some of it is obviously feeling good on the bike. Was there other things that you think fell into place to help bring those results?
No, cause like at the start of the season, like the first race in Chile, I had all good stages and then I would have probably been top 10 easy there anyway on my max six, which was 27.5, and then Colombia I was 11th in the mud, which it can go either way in the mud, so I knew that the speed was there, and then yeah, just getting the right tools for the job, so it was, I always felt like I was on the cusp because I was doing, you know, like when I was having top 10 stage times and a couple of top three ones before those races. It's just about, you know, and when it clicks, it clicks. There's no way to describe it. It's like you get better results, but it seems like it's easier. I don't know how to explain it. It's like it's that flow state, I guess.
Yeah, I guess a confidence thing of there's a difference between believing you can be on the podium at one of those events and actually proving to yourself that you can do it, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. And it's it's just about crossing that line. And there's no way I can describe it because you might go from three in a row and then never get a podium again. And you're always searching for that secret recipe, but you don't quite know what it is. And it can be a combination of things, but it's such a mental game.
Yeah. Yeah. So does that mean you're kind of wanting to have a serious go at the overall EWS for 2019 now that you've proven to yourself that you can be up there with those boys?
That's what everyone thinks, but like the overall isn't really, the overall in either sports isn't really something that motivates me. If there was a, because sometimes some of the enduro, some of the, like, I, downhill's the love of my life, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, the way I liken it to is, like, downhill's Formula One and enduro's like Le Mans. And so the feeling that you get out of laying down a sick downhill run is, it's like nothing beats it. But then enduro's just, it's rewarding because you've got to be tactical, you've got to, you know, it rewards consistency, it's an all-around bike handler. But next year I probably won't race the whole enduro series. I want to do just the same as like what I did this year, because I've still got goals in downhill, and you know, and I want to keep trying to achieve those before making a switch. And whether or not I ever make a full switch, I don't know. But at this stage, I'm just really enjoying doing both. And I think they complement each other really well.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. There's obviously been a lot of chat about that since Martin came over and showed what he was capable of yet again in downhill. What are your thoughts on combining both? Is the training, can it be detrimental, or do they complement each other?
I think it depends on where you live. Martin's case is probably completely different to mine, but then we're completely different riders. But so for me, the enduro training for me, like, it's I enjoy it, and you know, so like I don't mind going out. I get out all the time and just go for 3 hour rides and try to get a bunch of meters climbing. But then the downhill riding is the fun stuff. So I'm rewarded by going to the bike park and getting to punch out like 12 laps. And the enduro keeps, like, I think that you can't be too fit for downhill. I think there's some, you know, some guys are like, maybe, you know, if you're struggling on a 4 minute track and you're a pro, then you shouldn't be.
Yeah, fair point.
The enduro keeps you really fit and in check for downhill, and the downhill gives you raw speed and keeps you, you know, fired up for enduro. Because I think if I only raced enduro over time, I think you become a bit of a pussy. when we're riding these tracks, there's like little gaps and stuff that people are worrying about. And if a downhill race, it's, you know, the whole field has to, if there's a gap and one guy's doing it, then the whole field has to do it. Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
So it keeps you sharp then, I guess.
Yeah, I reckon they both work so well together, for me at least.
What about the fatigue over a season though? If there's a lot, you know, there's a lot going on, you're kind of traveling a lot, back-to-back events. The EWS is a lot of riding over 2 days racing, 2 days practice. Yeah. Do you think it's manageable from a fatigue perspective?
I don't know, because like last season was probably the biggest season I'd done, because I was also doing crankworks and stuff. Towards the end, I was getting tired. You know, Whistler, after that EWS, I just had to chill before Le Bresse, because I was pretty burnt out. For me, maybe next year I'm just going to try and be a bit smarter and, maybe not do all the crankworks events, or just pick your battles and make sure you've got enough rest, because yeah, it was fatigue definitely does come into it. And you know, like I was saying before, if it's all in your head and you've just got to be enjoying yourself to really start performing, so yeah.
Fair enough. And you had an interesting accommodation experience on your first night in Le Bresse, didn't you, after
that
Whistler?
Oh, man, that was so funny. I was shitting bricks.
God, tell us a bit about that for people that don't know what happened.
Yeah, so like Bernard books, I'll do it real quick. Bernard books this accommodation, and we're driving to the to the accommodation. He's in the truck with Tom and we're in the van, so we're way ahead of them. So we get there and it's number 18 of Rue something in France. So we get to 18 and it's this big old farmhouse. It looks like something out of like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And we ring up Bernard and he's like, oh yeah, they said the door will be open. So we're like walking around and we find this little side door, which is in like a woodshed, but goes into the house. And we're like, oh sweet, this is it. Go inside. It looks pretty sketchy. Upstairs, there's like all these salamis and stuff hanging. And we're like, oh, okay, I guess, yeah. All right, it's a big house, it'll do. And then there's bedrooms and stuff, and there's sheets and stuff, not on the beds, but like just put on the bed. So we're like, I'll make the beds, and I just go to sleep. And then like an hour later, Bernard and Mike turn up, and they're cracking up, and they're like, they're laughing because they're saying that we're in the wrong place. But I've already set up, and I love sleeping, so I'm just like, nah, it's all good. You guys go. I'll just stay here and I'll come. No one's going to come and wake me up at like 7 in the morning. Famous last words. 7 in the morning rolls around and I just hear the door open and all these French people start filling in. And I'm only one room away from the room that they're in. And I was like, it was just a case of Goldilocks and the Three Bears. So I just lay face down, my heart pumping. And yeah, I was like, oh no, they're going to come in and they're going to be French and they're going to be angry. And then they went upstairs to the salami room and I just grabbed my shit and just bolted out the door. And I still didn't know.
Perfect way to get over jet lag.
Yeah, but the funny thing is I still didn't know which house was ours. So it was 7 in the morning and I was just cruising around with my little wheelie bag going like, oh, where are these guys? Trying to find the van.
Excellent. That's exactly how you want to arrive at a World Cup, isn't it? Makes life easier.
Yeah, it was good.
Good stuff. So how was your downhill season? Started off with Lozenge, which people seem to either kind of enjoy or hate.
Yeah, I didn't mind Lozenge. I mean, in the back of your head, it was one of those tracks where you're just like, don't crash, because if I crash, I'm just going to get cheese grated. But I didn't mind it. I thought it was, the tracks these days are so fast. So anytime that they run a slowy, techie one, kind of like Le Bresse or Lozenge, yeah, I'm all for it because sometimes it feels like you're just risking your life when you're like racing. But yeah, Lozenge was good. I qualified 8th, so I was like, boom, yeah, great start. Here we go. And then broke my chain in the final. And got 29th or something. But I was like, yeah, take a lot out of that weekend. It's sweet.
Yeah, it's a solid start, isn't it?
Yeah, Fort William, I got caught out with the new kind of, because I was on the number 20 plate, but I wasn't protected. And then it started raining when we were at the top of the hill. And depending on which race we're at, I either wear gloves or no gloves, depending on the rule. But I've got like 2 sets of grips that I use. And it started raining and I had my no gloves grips on. And I blew a hand on one of the fastest parts of the track and had what was probably one of the most spectacular crashes I've had. So I was pretty lucky to walk away from that. But, yeah, Leo Gang was all good. Andorra was sick. I got 9th, and that's like been – I've been chipping away at trying to get a top 10 for about 3 years since I got my first top 20. So it was really rewarding, you know, just to do that and, you know – to be able to give my mechanic prize money for the first time at a World Cup was a bloody good feeling. So I was, yeah, some really good memories.
That's awesome. I didn't. Is prize money only for the top 10? I didn't realize how that works.
Prize money for the top 10. So yeah, but it's just, you know, we're pretty tight. Me and Kurt, my mechanic. So yeah, he was stoked and I was stoked. So it's really cool to be able to just get those little goals ticked off.
Yeah, and that was the weekend before Le Tour as well, wasn't it? So that maybe helped your kind of momentum into that third place at the Tour.
Yeah, you just like looking back on it, you can just see things building and it just kind of naturally happens. So yeah, and then going into Le Tour, which was like some of the enduros this year were like some of the hardest riding technically that you could do. So it was almost like oh man, we're at a downhill race, mint, we can just practice 10 times before we have to race. And then you go to an enduro and you're like, holy shit, this is like 20 times steeper, rootier than the World Cup, and I only get to do one run down it, and now it's raining.
Yeah, it looked brutal, the Latouille stuff. I've spoken to a few of the people that were racing there since, and they said it was kind of fun to ride, but pretty scary to race there.
Oh yeah, like the whole EWS this year, it feels like it seems like it's almost been a bit of a game of one up with the event organizers, and they're trying to make each race gnarlier than the other, and the weather hasn't really been playing ball for some of them, but shit, it's been some of them are sketchy. Yeah, white eyes, brown pants the whole way down.
Awesome. That's why you do it though, right? You love it.
Yeah. Ride cool. To survive.
Yeah. And then on to world champs, Lenzerheide. That was a good result as well.
Yeah, that was cool. Like I've always, prior to Andorra, my best result was at Lenzerheide where I got 11th. And that's where the whole goal of getting a top 10 started, because there's a bunch of us who are, we call it the 11 club. So Wynn's best result's 11th, Matt Walker's best result's 11th, Reese Wilson's best result was 11th. So to get out of the 11 club was pretty cool. But got 12th at Lenzerheide and had a cool Worlds bike. It was my first ever one, and it was a sweet race to finish the season on.
Awesome. And where, at what point did you pick up your injury?
At my first ever World Cup at Val d'Isol in 2012.
So it's still from that you've had surgery for this winter?
Yeah.
Oh, right, okay. So you finished, you didn't do the last couple of rounds of EWS to go and get that looked at. Is that how it worked?
Yeah, it just meant, missing those last two races, which I probably wouldn't have done them anyway, because I was, like I said, I was kind of burnt out. Well, I wasn't burnt out, but I was ready for a break from bikes. There's only so much bikes that you can do. So I went home for a week and just went skiing and hung out with mates and then had surgery.
Yeah. So what impact has that been having on you up until the surgery? Is it cause issues when you're riding?
I mean, when I was showing people, I could probably side to side, I could move my leg like maybe 4 inches, that's only like when you put it in a position to show them, but when you've got your muscles engaged and stuff, and on a bike, everything's pretty linear. So it was never any problems. Like it never seemed like a problem. So I just rode a knee brace and that's why I think, I'd always, if I wasn't riding for like 6 weeks, my muscle in that leg would like deteriorate really quickly. So, and then I'd be really clumsy and start tripping up. So, people always say that I'm like a secret trainer, but it was kind of out of necessity. So, to keep your muscles built up, to be able to keep doing what we're doing. So it wasn't, I could have just not done it this year, but, I guess as I'm getting older, it's only going to, the longer you put it off, the longer your recovery is going to be. So I thought I'd have a crack. And even if it doesn't, if it doesn't work, I know that I can just, I'll be fine without it, because I was So,
is it a reconstruction then? Have they taken muscle from somewhere else?
They call it harvesting. So they harvested my hamstring and replaced my ACL, and then stitched the meniscus.
Wow, full on, yeah. So what's the recovery like from that? What have you been having to do to kind of get through all of that?
My recovery so far has it's been almost too good. So so it's really the hardest thing with an ACL is that after about 3 months, which is where I'm at, is that you really feel like you're starting to get back to normal, but the 3 months to 6 months is when it's the highest chance of re-injury. So, yeah, I'm just basically forcing – I'm not going to ride my mountain bike until maybe the middle of February. Just doing rehab, working with physios and just trying to rebuild the muscle to be as functional and, but it's kind of cool because it's like my left leg was always quite a bit weaker, So now it's like you've got a clean slate. So, and I'm quite, I found it all quite interesting, the strength and conditioning side of it. So learning new things and you're just trying to make it as strong as possible.
Yeah. So have you got some pretty funky exercises that make you look ridiculous in the gym?
Yeah, I do a few glute clams.
Nice.
Yeah. I feel like the yoga girls, but I'm like in the middle of the gym with all the grunters just doing glute kickbacks and stuff with no weights. So they must think I'm a weirdo, but yeah, you got to do it. There's no,
yeah. Some of that stuff's pretty hard though, isn't it? It looks easy, but, and maybe looks a bit ridiculous, but it's pretty hard.
Yeah. Especially when you like, yeah, just trying to like get your brain to engage that muscle group. Yeah. Once you get it firing, it's not as easy as it might look.
Yeah. And have you been doing anything else like with supplements or bone broth or like, I don't know, acupuncture or anything like that to help it? Is there anything kind of clever going on?
No, I just do a couple of massages a week. I'm not huge on the supplements. I never felt like I needed to, kind of thing. I just listened to my body. So, I mean, I have protein powder after a big ride and stuff, but that's about the extent of my supplementation, because from what I've been reading, it can get you in a bit of trouble.
Yes, that is very true. Yeah, I was gonna ask about your thoughts on that, actually. How did you feel kind of seeing that come out?
First of all, I was just gutted for Jared, because it's just something that, like, you know, he's got a big enough battle on his hands to have to deal with that.
Sure. Crap.
And yeah. Everyone's going to have an opinion, so I'll probably just keep my opinions to myself. But I just gutted for like Chris Ball or for the enduro guys, because it's the first ever drug test they did in the sport, and they tested 6 people and they caught 2, so it doesn't look good.
Yeah. Hopefully it brings some clearer.
Oh, I think the
SCI, stuff in the future.
The SCI is going to be great. Like people, I guess Chris Ball's a smart dude, so he's not handed the reins over to the UCI, but he's just brought them in to kind of be the enforcers of the rules. Because prior to that, there was kind of a lot of sketchy stuff going on, which we don't need to go into. But I think from a rider's point of view, it's just going to make it. But it's just going to be better having someone who's not a stakeholder making the calls.
Yeah, someone whose only job is to police it, I guess, which is quite a nice thing to have there to keep it. And I think, fair, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's going to be good because, yeah, like I said, there's some things that have gone on in the past, and then they've got to hand out punishments. But then sometimes, you know, if it's got to be black and white, the rules.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
How do you approach your nutrition then? Have you been giving the vegan thing a go? I'm sure I read that somewhere.
Well, I was talking about this last night my parents had some vegans over for dinner. While I've been at home, I've just been free for all and just eating whatever. My mum's pretty wacky and she like we eat rabbits and all the random stuff. But during the season, yeah, me and Ruth, like, we're good friends with Mark Scott, so we went and stayed with him, and he's pretty strict vegan. Not more for performance side of things though. And me and Rupert were like, we'd go do 1500 meters climbing, and then we'd just chow into a pack of cookies and eat whatever, can of Coke. And we're like, well, we just did that. We could eat whatever we want, you know, in and out. It's just fuel. But then Mark made a good point. He was like, well, that's not a really good, even if it is just fuel and it doesn't matter, you should be trying to put the best fuel in. And he said, oh, you guys wouldn't even be able to do it if you tried. We were like, oh, easy. So, yeah, we went not full vegan, because I still eat, like, salmon and stuff, but no dairy and just mainly plant-based for, like, probably 3 months. And I'll probably go back to it for the season. So just because when you're on the road, it just forces you to eat healthy. And, and there's never any I don't really have any fluctuation with weight anyway, but you do notice, like, if you've got a low body fat, if you eat crap food for a week, you do put on, like, a little bit of fat here and there. But with the kind of plant-based stuff, it's really easy just to keep it on the straight and narrow.
Yeah. Did you feel any difference in your energy levels when you're on it?
Like, it's funny, the word got out around the pits that Eddie and Rupert had gone vegan, and people just come bowling into our pits and they're like, how do you feel? Like, are you getting enough energy? Like, are you okay? No, I didn't feel any different. And that's why I think I'll probably go back to it. But I'm not like, if we go out for a team dinner, of course I'm going to order the most expensive steak. But for me, like, I wasn't a huge meat eater anyway. So I think the biggest thing was, I think cutting out dairy just made my, like, I didn't feel like I had oily skin on my face and stuff. So it was quite nice. But
interesting. Yeah. It's hard to know what to do. There's so many kind of people pushing different things that it's hard to choose one, but vegan seems pretty popular and everyone that's been on it seems to do all right with it. So
yeah, I mean, like, I don't think there's much performance gain, but same, it always just comes back. If you think you're doing the right thing, then keep doing it.
Yeah, that's very true. There's a good part of it's mental, isn't it? So yeah cool. All right, well, I did a bit of research this afternoon. I was digging back and I watched a load of your videos, some for the first time, some again. You've done some great stuff. I sort of forget, like, with the Spirit of Enduro videos and the fat bike stuff. And then I really like the Firebird 29er launch vid as well, which is one I hadn't seen until today.
Yeah.
Out of all of that, what's been your favorite video project to work on?
Did you watch the Dirt Diaries one from Whistler?
I haven't seen that one, no.
I entered the Dirt Diaries, which is like a video competition in Whistler, and recruited the Vanzacs as my crew. And so we made this video, and I kind of had an idea to rehash the Hangover movie, but in Whistler. And it was really fun. They gave us $1,000 to make the movie, but we had a mate from Whistler who was filming for us. So we basically, we had to film a party scene. So we spent most of the money and legit partied with it and just filmed it.
Awesome.
And it was a really fun video to make, and everyone loved it. Yeah. So yeah, go and watch that. It's it was good fun.
Nice one. I'll put a link into the show notes so people can find that one. And I haven't seen that.
But good stuff. I guess while I've been injured, I'll probably have to do the Spirit of Enduro, the return for when I get back on the bike.
For sure. Yeah, we haven't had a Spirit of Enduro for a little while, have we? So
I've got one. When I get ideas, I just put them down on my phone. So I've got a full one planned out, but I just need to get around to making it.
So is video something you think you'll do more of, like, post a racing career? Is it part of the future for you?
I don't know. I just when I get an idea, just go with it. So it's all pretty organic. I really don't like trying to plan I just like it to be an idea that people have come up with rather than like forcing humor or stuff like that. I'm not into that. And you can definitely tell when stuff's forced.
Yeah. Whose idea was it to put a fat bike on the back of a boat then? A jet boat?
That was my one. And I was like, it worked too well. I was like, we'll try it. All it was a piece of plywood with some like ratchet straps strapping the bike to it. And I was like, oh, it'll be funny if it fails, and if it works, it'll be good. So like, it's win-win. And it worked so well. Like, I would love, like, yeah, you're on a bike on water, and to turn, you kind of like have to manual, because it had no fins, so you have to bend the plywood to like turn. It was pretty cool.
Weird. It must have felt quite interesting to ride it.
Yeah. And then like, because it had no fins, when he'd turn, you'd like drift. So a couple of times we caught an edge and just got fully high-sided. So yeah. But
nice.
It was pretty, that was actually pretty fun. But this was in September, so it was like snowing in Queenstown, and I was so cold. Yeah.
Good work though. Keep putting them out. They're awesome. Yeah. Awesome for everyone to watch. It's good crack. So you mentioned hangovers. I get really, really bad hangovers. Everyone that knows me knows I'm pretty useless on a hangover.
Yeah.
But you seem to be, or you have a reputation for kind of being at a party yet still train hard and race. You got any tips?
Nah, it's definitely changing a little bit. It's smoke and mirrors sometimes. Now, back in, it's funny that you say that, because, I used, when I was, you know, because I never, like, came into this to be a pro, so it was kind of like, oh, let's just try to ride this out for as long as I can. So I thought, like, you know, it could have went tomorrow, so, like, have a good time, make it last while it lasts. So, yeah, I used to be, it'd be, like, in Queenstown, start of the season, or heading into the season, and then the boys would be like, oh, come out, so we'd go out, and I'd feel real guilty, so I'd come home at, like, 3 in the morning and just be out on the street doing intervals to try and, so you know, work hard, play hard. So yeah, I'd feel really bad because I knew that I really probably shouldn't be out. So then I'd offset it by coming home and doing intervals up the street at 3 in the morning, going to bed, and then yeah. But I don't really do that now. But I get pretty bad hangovers. So yeah, you've got to pick your battles when it comes to partying these days.
Okay, so part, yeah, selective partying.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, fair enough.
The frequency is definitely not as high as it used to be.
But the parties are still good when they happen, yeah?
Oh, yeah. My friends that I hang out with, I guess they're the Vanzacs. Because I'm like a little bit older than some of them, so they are in their prime. So when I want to go out, yeah, it's always on.
Excellent. Good stuff. You mentioned being a pro rider. There's a lot of people out there that kind of want to get sponsored or want to get picked up by a team. What, with what you know about the industry and with your kind of marketing background as well, what do you think sponsors are looking for these days? Are they looking for people who are kind of serious about sport, people having a bit of fun? Are they looking for results, or is it more about exposure? Like, what are people after?
I mean, like, I think like what the 50 to 1 boys are doing is, that kind of epitomizes, if I was a marketing guy, what I'd be looking for, because those guys are really inspiring young kids to ride bikes, and young kids who are riding bikes are buying bike products. So, you know, yeah. But then from a race side, yes, results matter, but it's not the be all and end all. So if you're having fun and you're, because it's, you know, people are never going to give you shit if you're enjoying yourself. So yeah, if you're having fun and you're making, and people are noticing it, then, it'll happen. But you can't like, a lot of stuff's luck. Like my whole career, it's like right time, right place. And I feel really lucky to have, you know, stumbled across these opportunities, and it's so, yeah, if you really love mountain biking, eventually it'll happen. And if it doesn't, you're still doing it because you like it.
Yeah. Yeah. True.
Yeah.
Cool. So what are the plans for 2019 then? A bit of both again, or full DH season with some EWS thrown in?
It'll probably be a bit of both. So there are some clashes, so I probably won't, I won't be racing all the downhills and I won't be racing all the enduros. But we kind of just cross those bridges when we come to them. Like, if there's one race that's an enduro that doesn't sound as good, and then the one that it is clashing with Val de Sol, then maybe I'll race Val de Sol. So it's, we kind of just figure it out as we go and see how we're going. And if I'm winning the World Cup overall, I'll probably just go race your enduro.
Awesome. And any venues that you're particularly looking forward to next year on either the EWS or the downhill side? Because there's a few kind of returning venues and new venues.
I'll just have to pull up my calendar, see where they are. Oh, Madeira. Sick. Yeah, Madeira's mint. Like, we went there 2 years ago, and it's like, I like surfing, so we went for a week and we're just surfing, and it's such a cool place. I've never been anywhere like that. It's like Jurassic Park. I mean, Rotorua is cool because we never get to race at home. And I'm stoked to go to America for the World Cup, because
yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah, it's cool that, like, I mean, the Americans are killing it. Like, Luca, Aaron, Dak, they're all like, they've really brought that scene back, and now races are coming back to America. So hopefully it just keeps, hopefully the ball just keeps rolling. Like, Nico, he's doing heaps of good work for you know, it seems like he's been pretty pivotal in making America great again.
Yeah, he's definitely been working away, making sure good stuff's going on over there.
He needs to get the Make America Great Again hat.
He does. Yeah. There you go. Christmas present. Get him one quick.
Yeah. But, yeah. Wicked. So there's some, I mean, pretty lucky that downhill and enduro both have such cool races. Downhills, like, a lot of them are the same, but the races are still, like, I love going to Fort William. Fort William is probably my favorite event just because you really feel like you're, when you're coming into that finish corral of like 20,000 people, you're like, this is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's insane. The atmosphere there is just, it's mind-blowing on race day.
My parents went and watched 2 years ago, and they bought some friends who had no interest in mountain biking at all, and they loved it. They couldn't believe how awesome it was. Yeah, and so I think they're going to come back this year because, yeah, it's just so cool. Whether or not you're into mountain biking or not, it's such a well-run event, and the atmosphere is puts goosebumps on my neck.
Yeah. Do any of the other venues come close? La Bresse, obviously, the French crowd are pretty famous for being rowdy.
Yeah, it was a bit shit that it rained a bunch at La Bresse because I think we probably would have had two times as many spectators. But this year, Lenzerheide watching Nino and Yolanda in the cross country in front of what someone said 70,000 people, or maybe that was the whole weekend. But when they were chanting Nino, yeah, it was full hairs on the back of your neck standing up because shit, it was like, man, and there's no way he was going to lose. Not when the whole crowd was just chanting Nino, and it was, yeah, that was pretty cool to actually be there.
Amazing. Yeah, that'd be cool.
So that's probably, that was probably the biggest crowd I'd ever seen. And it was pretty emotionally charged. They were so into it. Yeah, it was wicked.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, we need more events like that for sure. Mm. Cool. And you've just got back from Cannonball with Thredbo, is that right, in Australia?
Yeah.
Is that their biggest event?
Yeah. Yeah. It's I think they had 1,000 competitors, which is across all disciplines. But like, I mean, they had 400 or something, 300 or 400 in the downhill alone. And then they have like an all mountain race, they have like a flow track, pump track, whip offs. So it's a full on mountain bike festival. And yeah, so I went like 2 years ago, and then this with a crew, and the same crew were going. So I was like, "Oh shit!" I just booked in ahead, knowing that I'd be able to walk and stuff. So I was like, "I'll come along, hang out, catch up with some friends." So it was cool, and then all the syndicate guys were there. And it was pretty wicked because Nathan Rennie was back; he was riding.
I saw that.
Yeah, and like he's such a legend. Yeah, a little bit starstruck actually when you're talking to Rennie because he's like the man.
Yeah, were you racing at the same time as him or on World Cup circuit, or was he gone by then?
Not really, nah. Maybe I was, but probably right when he was, it was just, I was coming in, he was going out, but maybe,
yeah.
Or maybe he left a year earlier. But so I don't really know him personally, but I'm a huge like downhill fan, and I'm like, if I want to fire up, I watch Earth 1, 2, 3. I don't watch any of the other stuff. Yeah. So, it's pretty cool to see people like him still coming back and like being part of the scene. It's sick.
Yeah, definitely. That's the first time I've seen his face since he left the World Cup circuit. Yeah. I think so. It's cool. And you did a little bit of TV out there, Tobol TV.
Yeah.
Which I watched just before we hopped on this call. It's awesome, man. It's really good to see. How long did it take you to get that Danny Hart impression down?
What, Danny Hart? I don't know. Danny's we hang out with Danny quite a bit, so he's always in the pits giving Bernard shit. It's a bit smoke and mirrors. He's actually a bit of a joker and he's a real funny dude, but on video and stuff you don't really kind of see that, so people kind of might have a misconception, but had a bit of practice.
I get the impression he's got a bit of a mischievous side.
Oh, yeah, he does. And, like, yeah, but then I guess from the outside looking in, like all the keyboard warriors on Pink Bike probably wouldn't see this. And same with G. I guess G's done like his whole career playing the villain, and now he's becoming like a favorite. You know, like when he was battling with Stevie, everyone wanted Stevie to win, and Manar, same thing. So it's pretty cool that, yeah. But G's the man as well.
Yeah, it's cool. It's nice to see people getting behind him when he didn't get selected for the world's team. And it is good, because I've met him a few times and he's always been super nice.
People forget like how gnarly he is. Like, he's the one, you know, like he's the guy in the field who will like have the hugest crash and break bones, and he'll always race. So he's like, yeah. He's a diehard mountain biker.
For sure. Yeah, he's a tough one.
Yeah.
Cool. Right. We're getting close to the end of our time together. So we've got three questions that we've thrown at pretty much everyone. So hit those up. First one, it's normally £150. I've done the conversion today. At the current rate is $277 New Zealand dollars. If our listeners had that to spend to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they spend it on?
I want to make a joke about Richie and Jared, but that's probably bad.
I'll let you decide.
No, I won't do that. what would they do? I was listening to one the other day and someone said coaching, but so I can't say that. I'm a firm believer in you need to have your contact points dialed, pedals, grips, seat. So if you're getting arm pump, change your grips up. Have good pedals if you, I don't know. But wouldn't really change performance.
It might make you more confident, which is always going to make you faster, isn't it?
Yeah, or what I could do. It's just coaching. Yeah, coaching is like it would be the best way to spend your money, because sometimes you just look at someone doing something and you can just see it straight away, like what they're doing wrong, and they would never be able to tell, but someone can point it out, and it can be this such a small little adjustment, it can make so much difference.
Yeah, cool. You mentioned earlier that you had two different sets of grips that you use, one with gloves and one without. What are your non-glove grips? I'm interested to know, because I've tried riding without gloves.
The ODI long necks. Yeah, so they're like a BMX grip that's it's like a bunch of rings going along the thing. And you can get them as slip-on or lock-on, but when I have the lock-on one, I cut the outside lock-on off.
So is that just because it's more comfortable without that hard end on the grip?
Yeah, because I guess just the way I hold my hands. So I just, it's really easy to do. You just hacksaw the little plastic lugs off. My normal ones are I wouldn't even know what they're called. Just the pretty bog standy ODI grip, but it also only has a inside lock on.
And you would choose gloveless ideally if the legislation doesn't push you otherwise.
Yeah, I'd go gloveless for downhill, but then in enduro, I run gloves because sometimes, like in a 20-minute stage, you're gonna get sweaty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fair play. All righty. Next question. If you could wind back the clock and sit down with yourself age 16, what advice would you give him?
Probably just to slow down, take it all in. Yeah. I don't have any regrets at all. I used to rush and I used to stress out about little, you know, don't sweat the small stuff. Just keep on keeping on. I don't really have any regrets. I'm pretty happy with how I've done things so far.
Cool. Yeah, it seems to have worked out pretty good. Riding bikes for a living.
Yeah.
All good. All right, last question then. If you could have a coaching session with anyone, past or present, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them?
Coaching session, I probably wouldn't do a coaching session as much as I would just go riding with Rat Boy, because even though like he's a good friend of mine, you go riding with him and he just does these little things that just like blow you away, and you'll be behind just like, yeah, this is, yeah. So he's like, and you can see that in those like movies like Wheel Love and stuff. A lot of the stuff like Rat Boy will be doing are like one take, you know, just creative. And yeah, so he's pretty cool to ride with. And yeah, so I just pay and just go riding with him.
Sounds good to me. Yeah. I'll get in on that day. That'd be fun.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you so much for taking time out and coming on. It's been great to sit down. We're looking forward to seeing how you get on with 2019. Hope the recovery goes well. And hopefully we'll see you on podium at EWS and downhill.
Yeah. Nah, hopefully. And thanks for having me. It's always good to sit down, chat, talk some shit, and yeah, maybe people might not know as much about me. So yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
Nice one. It's a pleasure. Cheers, man.
Great, dude.
Right, that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed listening. If you did, don't forget to leave us a review over on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. It really helps us out. Massive thank you to the Trailhead Bicycle Company for supporting this episode. And don't forget, if you want to help support us, then you can grab a t-shirt or a mug from our web store at downtimepodcast.com/shop. We've got a special episode with Johnny from Fit for Racing coming later this week, so make sure you're subscribed so that you get that delivered to your device as soon as it's available. All right, that's it for now. But until next time, get out and ride.